In a gesture of love, I'll bring it to you. Yes, I want to die holding it.
You don't think I'm going to disappear, do you?
No, not at all.
Keep yourself in check.
I am.
Whether I come back, that's the question. I said something under my breath. But I'll try. Try with all my might. This must be tested now.
I leaned over and took with her the liberty she'd taken with me. I kissed her. Her passion passed through me completely. It burned in me. Now, in my heart, I spoke the requisite words. Depart from me, all particles of this earthly body. Yet do not return to where you belong, but await my command that you come together instantly when I would have you.
I vanished.
At once the body dispersed, sending out a fine mist to all the inner surfaces of the plane, leaving a shimmering spray upon the leather, the windows, the ceiling. I floated above, free, fully shaped and strong, and I looked down at the empty seat, and I saw the top of Rachel's head, and I heard her scream. I rose up through the plane. It was no harder than passing through anything else. But I felt the passing. I felt the shivering energy and heat of the plane. And then the plane shot onwards at such terrific velocity that I fell towards the earth as if I had weight. Down, down through the dark until I swung free, spreading my arms and moving towards Gregory. Find the bones, servant. Find your bones. Look after the bones. In the wind, as always, I glimpsed other souls. I saw them struggling to see me and to make themselves visible. I knew they sensed my vigor, my direction, and for a moment they flashed and glittered and blinked, and then they were gone. I had passed through them and their world, their horrid layer of smoke that surrounded the earth like the filth hanging over burning dung, and I sped forward, like singing, towards the bones, towards Gregory. The bones, I said. The bones, I said into the wind. The lights of the city of New York spread out in all directions, more magnificent and tremendous than the lights of Rome at its greatest, or of Calcutta, now full of millions upon millions of lamps. I could hear Gregory's voice. And then, before me in the dark, there appeared the bones, tiny, distant, certain, and golden. Chapter 20. It was a large room, not in the apartments of Gregory and Rachel, but higher in the building. I realized for the first time that the building itself was the temple of the mind of God, and it throbbed throughout its many floors with people. The room itself glistened with steel and glass and tables made of manipulated stone, hard as anything mined from the earth. Machines lined the walls, and cameras which moved as the inhabitants of the room moved. There were plenty of inhabitants. I entered invisible, easily passing through all barriers, as if I were made of tiny fish and the walls were nets. I wandered among the tables, eyeing the video screens in rows on the walls, the computers set into niches, and other devices which I couldn't understand. Silently, broadcasts from all over the planet came in on these video screens. Some of them showed the news that all people can receive. Others were obviously monitoring particular and private places. The spy monitors were the most dull, greenish, murky. The bones lay in the very middle of the room on a sterile table. The casket, empty, lay to the side. The men surrounding Gregory were obviously physicians. They had the poise and attitude of learned men. Gregory was in mid-conversation describing the bones as a relic, which must be analyzed in every conceivable way without bringing harm to it. X-rayed, carbon-dated, minute scrapings made for contents.
attempt at aspiration if anything inside were liquid. Gregory was shaken, disheveled. He wore the same clothes as before, but he was not the same man. "You're not listening to me," he said fiercely to these his loyal court physicians. "Treat this as priceless," he said. "I want no mishaps. I want no leaks to the press. I want no leaks within this building. Do this work yourself. Keep the jabbermouth technicians away from it." The men took all this in stride. Not fawning like lackeys, they wrote notes on their clipboards, exchanged glances of agreement with one another, and nodded with dignity to the man who paid the bills. I knew their kind. Very modern scientists who are just learned enough to be certain that nothing spiritual exists, that the world is completely material, self-created, or the result of some Big Bang, and that ghosts, spells, God and the devil were useless concepts. They weren't by nature kind. In fact, there was a peculiar hardness which they all shared, not a sinister quality so much as a moral deformity. It was in their demeanor, but I caught it merely from scanning them carefully. All these men had committed crimes of some kind, with medicine, and their status was entirely dependent upon the protection of Gregory Belkin. In other words, this was a gang of fugitive doctors, hand-picked to do special jobs for Gregory. It struck me as marvelously good luck that he had committed the bones to this pack of fools, rather than to magicians. But then where would he find a magician? What a different scene this might have been if he had called upon the Hasidim, Zadiks who didn't hate or fear him, or on Buddhists or Zoroastrians. Even a Hindu doctor of Western mind might have been a danger. I took an upright stance, still invisible, then drew close, until I was touching Gregory's shoulder. I smelled his perfumed skin, his fine silken face. His voice was crisp and angry, concealing all his anxiety as if it were a cloud that he could collect and swallow, and let out only in a perfect narrow stream of fluid speech. The bones. I felt nothing as I saw them. "Do some good mischief here. Get the scarf and get back to Rachel." Obviously the moving of the bones had no effect on me, neither did the prying eyes of these doctors. "Am I finished with you now?" I spoke to the bones. But the bones gave no answer. They were not in order. They were a haphazardly gathered skeleton, tumbled, their gold brilliant under the electric lights. Flecks of cloth clung to them like bits of leaves or dirt. Ashes clung to them, but they seemed as solid as ever, as enduring. For all time. Was my soul, my tselem, locked within them? "Do I need you any more? Can you hurt me, Master?" Gregory knew I was there. He turned from right to left, but he couldn't see me. The others, and there were six, noted his agitation, questioned him. One man touched the casket. "Don't do it," said Gregory. He was wonderfully afraid. "I love this too much." There is always an element of pride in tormenting the solid and the living, but really it was so easy I had to restrain myself. To test him, and to test myself, that was my mission here, and I must not play games. "We'll handle them with extreme care, Gregory," said a young doctor amongst them. "But we're going to have to take some substantial scrapings. We've been through that. In order to get carbon dating and DNA, we may have to take—" "And you want full DNA, don't you?" asked another, eager for the eye and the favor of the leader. "You want everything we can come up with about this skeleton. Gender, age, cause of death, anything that might be locked inside there. You're going to be amazed what we can find out. The mummy project in Manchester, you saw all that?" Gregory gave them nods and stiff affirmations in silence because he knew I was there. I was invisible still, but now formed in all my parts and wearing my garments of choice, fluid enough to pass through him if I wanted to, which would have sickened him and hurt him and made him fall. I touched Gregory's cheek. He felt it, and he was petrified. I put my fingers into his hair. He drew in his breath. On and on came the science babble. "Size of the skull, a male, and the pelvis, probably, you realize—" "Be careful with them!" Gregory burst out suddenly. The scientists were silenced. "I mean treat them like a relic, you hear me?"
"Yes, sir, we understand, sir."
"Look, the scientists who do this work on Egyptian and—"
"Don't tell me how, just tell me what. Keep it secret. We don't have many days left, gentlemen."
"What could this mean?"
"I don't like stopping work for this, so do it at once."
"Everything's going splendidly," said an older doctor. "Don't worry about time. A day or two won't matter."
"I suppose you're right," Gregory said, crestfallen. "But something can still go wrong. Very wrong." They nodded only because they feared to lose his favor. They debated now. Speak, don't speak. Nod, bow, do what?
I drew in my breath and resolved to be visible. The air moved. There was a faint noise. The room felt a vague commotion as the particles gathered with tremendous force, yet I was taking no more than the first stage, the airy form. The doctors looked about in confusion. The first to see me pointed. I was transparent, but vividly colored, and perfectly detailed. Then the others saw me. Gregory spun around to his right and looked at me. I gave him my soft, evil smile. I think it was evil, anyway. I floated. In airy form, I had no need to stand, or to anchor. I was 1,000 degrees from the density that obeys gravity. I stood on the ground, but I didn't need to. This was a choice, like the position of a flower in a painting. He glared at me, seeing the thin mirage of a long-haired man, clothed as I had been when I left him, but thinner than glass.
"This is a holograph, Gregory," said one of the doctors. "It's being projected from somewhere," said another. The men began to look around the room. "Yeah, it's one of those cameras up there. It's some sort of trick." "Well, who the hell would dare pull a thing like this in your own—"
"Quiet," Gregory said.
He raised his hand for absolute obedience, and he got it. His face was locked with fear and despair.
"Remember," I said aloud, "I'm watching you."
The cohorts heard me and commenced whispering and shuffling.
"Put your hand through it," said the white-coated one closest to me.
When Gregory failed to obey, the young man approached and moved to do it. And I merely looked at him and watched him and wondered what he felt, if it was a chill or electric. His hand penetrated me easily, causing no seam in the vision. He drew back his hand.
"Somebody's gotten into security," he said quickly, looking me directly in the eyes.
They were all babbling again that someone was controlling the image, that someone somehow had figured a way to do this, and that it was probably— Gregory couldn't bring himself to answer. I had accomplished my purpose. He struggled desperately for some command, some powerful verbal weapon against me that wouldn't make him the fool in the eyes of the others. Then he spoke in a cold voice. "When you give me your reports, tell me exactly how these bones could be destroyed," he said.
"Gregory, this is a holograph, this thing. I want to call security."
"No," he declared. "I know who is responsible for this little trick. I have it covered. It merely caught me off guard. There's no breach. Get to work." His self-confidence and quiet air of command really were kingly. I laughed softly. I kissed his cheek. It was rough, and he drew back. But he faced me. The men were astonished by the gesture.
The men merely came closer, surrounding me, absolutely certain in their incredible ignorance and bigotry that I was an apparition being made electrically by someone else. For a moment I scanned their faces. I saw wickedness in their faces, but it was a brand of wickedness I didn't fully understand. It was too connected with power. These men loved their power. They loved their purpose. But what exactly was it that they did when they weren't analyzing relics? I let them study me, looking from face to face. Then I struck upon the mastermind. The tall, emaciated doctor, who in fact blackened his hair with dye, and who looked older than he was on account of his thinness. He was the brilliant one. His gaze was far more critical and suspicious than that of the others. And he monitored Gregory's responses with a cold calculation. "Look, this is all very fancy," said this one, "this holograph, but we can get on this analysis tonight. You realize we can give you an image like this, this holograph, of the man who once had these bones?"
"Can you really do that?" I asked.
"Yes, of course." He stopped, realizing he was talking to me. He began to make gestures all around me. So did the others. They were trying to interrupt the projection of the beam that they thought had created me. "Simple forensic procedure," said another, boldly ignoring the continuing strangeness of all this. "And we'll get on this security thing immediately." Others continued to search the ceilings and the walls. A man moved to a telephone.
"No,"
Gregory said. He stared at the bones. "Permeated with something, some chemical, obviously. Well, we can have all of that analyzed. I mean, we'll be able to tell you." Gregory turned and looked at me. A clearer comprehension of him came to me. This was a man who could only use everything that came to him. He was not passive in any meaning of that word. The frustration he felt now would fuel his rage and his invention. It would drive him to greater lengths. He was only holding firm now, biding his time. And what he learned now would enhance his cunning and his capacity to surprise. I turned to the doctors. "Let me know the outcome of your tests, will you?" I said, being a deliberately dreadful devil. This caused quite a flurry. I dissolved. I did it instantly. The heat passed out of me and the particles swarmed, too tiny, no doubt, for them to see. But the men felt the change in temperature. They felt the movement of the air. They were in confusion, looking around for another projected figure, perhaps, among them, for a switch in the direction of the light beam which they thought had made me appear. I understood something further about them. They regarded their science as omnipotent. Science was the explanation not only for me, but for anything and everything. In other words, they were materialists who beheld their science as magic. The irony of this was very funny to me. Anything I did, they would perceive to be science beyond their understanding. And I had been made by those who had been convinced that magic had the power of science, if you just knew all the right words. I went up and up, through the ceiling and the floor above it, rising through the shiny, bustling, crowded layers of the building, until I could not see the bones any longer. The golden glimmer was gone. I was in the fresh and cool night sky. "Find Rachel," I thought. "Your test is accomplished. You know now you are free. He can't stop you. Go now where you will." But in truth, the experiment would only be complete if I could make myself fully solid once more. The scarf. I had forgotten about the scarf. I drew down closer to the building. Only now did I really see its full height and grandeur. Covered all over, even to its top floors with granite, it sloped majestically as it rose, rather like an ancient place of worship. There must have been 50 floors. Numbers don't come to me automatically. We had been on the 25th floor just now. I descended, peering into the windows as I went, looking for the private living chambers. Offices. I saw hundreds of offices. I moved easily from right to left, amazed at the rooms filled with computers. And then I saw laboratories, highly elaborate laboratories, in which serious people were diligently studying tiny things beneath microscopes and measuring potions into vials, which they carefully sealed. What was this? Part of Gregory's religious rackets? Drugs for his followers? Spiritual medicines like the soma of the Persian sun worshippers? But there were so many laboratories. There were men and women in sterile white suits and masks, their hair carefully covered with white caps. There were giant refrigerators and warning signs against contamination. There were animals in cages, little gray monkeys with wide, frightened eyes. Doctors were feeding them. In one area, humans moved sluggishly, encased in very bright colored plastic suits, and with ominous windowed helmets worthy of modern warriors. Their hands were covered with giant, clumsy gloves. At their mercy, the monkeys chattered desperately and in vain in their little prisons. Some monkeys lay prostrate with illness or fright. Most curious. Some temple of the mind, I thought. At last I came down to perhaps the 12th floor, and there I saw the great demi-lune of a living room in which he and I had quarreled. I moved through the window easily and through the corridors, moving the doors back slowly and lightly so that it would seem a breeze. I saw Esther's bed. I saw her bed and her picture beside it, a smiling girl with others in a silver frame. And I saw across her snow-white bedspread the black beaded scarf, folded neatly. I was overcome with delight. As I entered the room physically, I sensed the perfume of Esther. Here she had slept. Here she had dreamed. On her dressing table, there lay diamond rings and earrings with diamonds, and bracelets with diamonds, a scattering of finery, all delicate and pretty with silver or gold. On the walls were photographs, Gregory, Rachel, Esther, together year after year. One picture had been taken on a boat, another on a beach, another at some ceremony or party which required gowns for the women. "Esther, tell me, who did it? Why? Would he kill you simply because you learned about his brother Nathan? Why would that matter to him, Esther?" But nothing came back from the surfaces of this room. The soul had gone straight into the light and taken every particle of pain or joy it had ever known along with it. It had left nothing. Ah, to be murdered and to rise so cleanly! I drifted towards the scarf. My hand grew denser and more visible as the weight of the fabric tumbled into it. It was beautifully woven, made of lace in its center, long, and trimmed all over with fine, small black beads, exactly as I remembered. It was heavy, very heavy. It was almost a shawl. It was strange and unlike other things of this time. Perhaps she had thought it exotic. The darkness moved around me. "Make yourself whole and flesh." I did. Something brushed me and flashed before me, dimly and uncertainly. But it was only a lost soul. The soul of an unburied man, perhaps, mistaking me in the mist for an angel, then moving on. Nothing to do with the chamber. I uttered a curse against the lost souls, and took my stand with the material world. I wound the scarf tight in my hands, dazzled again that I was formed and answerable to no one. And then, once more, keeping this scarf tight within my grip, I let the particles fly from me, and rolled my spirit round and round this scarf, this heavy scarf, so that I might carry it with me. I soared through the noise and smoke hovering over the city. For one moment I saw its lights below sprinkled exquisitely amid the clouds, the scarf like a great heavy stone in the very midst of my being, slowing me, giving me a rise and fall with the wind that felt oddly good. Like the birds, perhaps, I mused. Rachel, Rachel, Rachel. I pictured her as I'd left her, not below me, screaming at my disappearance, but how she had been when she was seated across from me, with large hard eyes and all the silver shimmering in her hair, as if it had been threaded there deliberately by 20 slaves to make her magnificent in age. Within seconds I felt close to her. I could almost see her. She moved through the night as swiftly as I did, and I circled her, rising high above her and then drawing near. I couldn't see her clearly enough. Her image was tangled with movement and light. It was the plane. I couldn't enter the plane. I wasn't sure enough to enter it. It was just going too fast. I didn't know if I had the strength. I didn't know if I could bring together the matter for a body in the compartment of such a swiftly moving machine. The whole technology of the plane seemed too full of contradictions and precarious adjustments. I imagined some hideous catastrophe in which I'd be knocked back once more into oblivion, unable to revive. If that happened, the scarf would fall to earth like a bit of burnt black forest, moving back and forth on the wind until it entered the lower atmosphere and then pooled on the ground. Esther's scarf, divorced from all things that had to do with her and those who loved her. Esther's scarf in some strange city. We were high above small cities. I drifted without making a choice. I wasn't uncertain, however. I would meet her, I resolved. I waited and I followed. The plane led me like a tiny firefly in the night. We were above the southern seas. The plane was circling and ascending. I saw then the great sprawl of Miami as I came down under the clouds. Glorious in this warm air, this sea-filled, watery air. Air as lovely as some ancient city where I had once been very happy as a spirit, learning from a wise man. I could almost... But I had to concentrate. I saw the long stream of eerie colored lights that made the ocean drive of Miami Beach. I saw it as clearly as if she'd drawn me a map, and I saw the building with the pink beacon atop it, the very last one on the bony finger of the peninsula. Slowly I descended, not close to the building, but a few blocks from it, drifting quickly into the large crowd that moved along the street, between the beach and the cafes. The warm air was grand and exhilarating. I almost cried for the sweetness of it, and the sight of the great sea, and the beautiful billowing clouds of the sky. I thought if I had to die, I should like to die here too. It was a remarkable mix of humans which surrounded me, wholly unlike the busy people of New York. These were pleasure-seekers, all rather agreeable, and all eyes for one another, yet most tolerant of the great casual variety of styles intermingled here, and the obvious mix of the very young in ostentatious, seductive attire, right along with the commonplace and the very old. But my clothes were not right. I glanced about at the men. Men wore loose garments, short pants, sandals. No, there was a man in a beautiful white suit, like Gregory's suit, with a shirt and open collar. I took that style. When my feet hit the pavement, I was dressed like that man, and carrying the scarf in my hand, and walking south on Ocean Drive toward Rachel's building. Heads turned. People smiled. People here looked at each other. People here wanted to see beauty. There was an atmosphere of festivity. Suddenly a girl grasped my arm. I was startled. I wheeled around and stopped and bowed. "Yes, what is it?" I asked. She was little more than a child with huge breasts, almost naked under her pink cotton tunic. Her hair was blonde and fleecy and gathered back with a big pink bow.
"Your hair. Your beautiful hair," she said.
She had a dreamy look.
"In this breeze it's a nuisance," I said, laughing.
"I thought that was it," she said. "When I saw you coming, you looked so happy, except your hair kept blowing in your face. Here, let me give you this."
She laughed with simple gaiety as she removed a long gold chain from around her neck. "But I have nothing to give you for it," I said.
"Your smile is what you gave me," she said.
And rushing behind me, she gathered my hair back at the nape of my neck and looped the chain around it.
"Ah, now you look cooler and more comfortable," she said, jumping in front of me.
Her little tunic barely covered her underwear, and she danced on naked legs and sandals that had only one buckle to them.
Thank you most kindly," I said with a deep bow.
"Oh, I wish I had something. I don't know where to—" How could I bring to myself some valuable object without stealing it? I felt ashamed as I looked at the scarf.
"Oh, I would give you this."
"I don't want anything from you," she said,
laying a little hand on mine and on the scarf.
"Smile again."
And when I did, she cried out with laughter. "I wish you blessings all your life," I said. "I wish I could kiss you." She stood on tiptoe, threw her arms around my neck, and planted on me a luscious kiss that woke every molecule of the body. I trembled, not able to gently remove her from me, but fast becoming her utter slave. And all this on the brightly lighted street in the brisk ocean breeze, with hundreds meandering on both sides. Something distracted me. It was a call. It was Rachel's call to me, and Rachel was very close, and she was crying. "I have to go now, pretty girl," I said. "You lovely girl." And I kissed her again and hurried down the street, trying to remember to walk at a human pace. I could see Rachel's building up the slope. I was there in less than 5 minutes. The kiss of the girl had been like a drink of wine for a mortal man. I was laughing to myself. I was so happy to be alive suddenly that I even felt a morsel of compassion for all those who had ever wronged me or anyone. But that passed fast enough. Hate was too much a part of my character. These kind, gentle people might melt it, however. These kind ones. Approaching the garden terraces of the building, I looked up at its glorious height. Then I climbed quickly over the fence and sprinted on the drive, hardly realizing that I had bypassed a security gate as I headed for the front doors of Rachel's home. A huge white limousine was parked there, and Rachel was just getting out of it. Richie, the faithful driver, had her by the arm. He was agitated, though silent. No reporters or anyone around. Only the building attendants in white uniforms, and the breeze rippling through the purple Egyptian lilies. I turned and saw the sea again stretching forever under the white clouds. This was like heaven to me. Then in the other direction, beyond the building, I saw an inland bay, more gleaming, dreamy, beautiful water, and beyond it towers of light. I love this world. As I drew up to her, I babbled with joy. "Look, Rachel, there's water all around us," I said. "And the sky is so visible, so high. Look at the curling and rolling clouds. You can see their shapes and their whiteness as if it's day here." She was rigid. She stared. I slipped the scarf into her hands and wound her hands up with it. "That's the scarf," I said. "It was on Esther's bed." She shook her head. She wanted to say things. She and the somber Richie both stared at me in plain shock.
"I've never fainted in my life," she said. "I think I might now."
"No, no, it's only me. I've come back. I saw Gregory. I know what he's up to. This is the scarf. Don't faint. But if you want to faint, go ahead. I'll carry you."
The wide glass doors swung open. Attendants preceded her with her leather bundle and some other suitcase I'd never seen before. Richie stared at me and shook his head. His wrinkled face showed anger. Then she came close. "Now you see," I said, "all I've told you is true."
"Is it?"
she whispered. She was dead white. "Come on, let's get inside," said Richie. He did pick her up, and he carried her in front of me to the elevator. Old as he was, he carried her inside easily in his arms. "Let me in," I said as the doors started to close. But Richie glared at me with a darkly furrowed brow, and jabbed the button and blocked my path. "All right, have it your way," I said. I met them at the top. It was just a speedy rush up the steps, rather like racing when I was a boy. Dumbfounded and enraged, and still carrying her, as she stared at me, Richie rushed to her doors and put the key in the lock. The attendants went in with her luggage. "Put me down now, Richie," she said. "It's okay. Wait downstairs. Take the others with you." "Rachel," he said. He was staunch, suffering. His gnarled old fingers were curled for a fight. "Why are you so afraid of me?" I asked. "You think I would hurt her?" "I don't know what to think," he said in a roughened, aged voice. "I'm not thinking." She pulled me into the door. "All of you, go," she said. I saw a blurred panorama of beautiful rooms, many open to the sea, and others open to a garden, just like the courtyard of our house when I was a boy, and the courtyard I could almost remember from that Greek city on the sea where I'd been most unhappy, and then happy. I was dazed. The loveliness of the place, its warmth, its windows framing heaven, is almost impossible to describe. It flooded me with love, and I think the memory of Zervan touched me, not with words but with revelations. I was washed clean by love and felt a sense of ease. I understood that there could be a world in which only love was the significant virtue. A sense of well-being overcame me. But I did not try to remember anything. Everywhere soft white curtains waved in the wind. The courtyard exploded with giant red African flowers, lovely purple vines, and the most lacy and soft trees, dancing in the captured breeze. The place was full of the scent of the flowers. Rachel slammed the front door on those outside, including her driver Angel. And she slid the lock and put up a little chain, and then she looked at me. "You believe me now?" I asked. She leaned towards me. "Let me hold you." She tumbled softly against me. "Take me to my bed," she said. "There, through the garden and over there, to the left, my bed." She put her arms around my neck, and I did as she said. She was light, perfumed, tender. It was the most marvelous room, open to the sea on all three sides. It was windows and windows. A rush of remembered warmth overcame me again. But where in the world had I ever seen such clouds, and tossed among them in the glowing light the stars, so friendly and small and kindly? I set her down on a huge bed of silk, covered with silk blankets and pillows. A soft golden color seemed to be in every fabric or tapestry or design in some way, and the room was filled with soft molded chairs, Turkish luxury. I smelled the salt and her perfumed sweetness, and I looked down on her wax-pure face. Tenderly as I could, I kissed her forehead. "Don't be afraid, darling one," I said. "Everything I told you was true. You must believe me. You must tell me what you know about Esther and Nathan." She began to sob, and then turned, faint and shivering, and nestled into the pillows. I sat there. I pulled up a silken cover over her,
something full of the French flowers. But she didn't need it.
"No, the air itself," she said. "The air. Kiss me again. Hold me again. Be with me.
I have you in my arms. My lips touch your forehead, your cheek, your chin, your shoulder, your hand," I said.
Truth was, I could hardly resist her. I wanted to loosen her fancy clothes, release her in my power. I softly locked my hand around her fragile wrist. She really was dying.
"Don't fear me, beloved," I said, "unless it eases the pain. Sometimes it does, to fear one thing instead of others." In answer, she turned and kissed me again, tugging my head down close to her, so that she could push her tongue into my mouth. It was a luscious kiss, full of passion and utter yielding. I kissed her longingly. I felt her hips lift against me. I felt my own body hard for her. I had to have her. I had to make her happy. And the world would let me know my power in this, as it had let me know in everything else. If I lost all power in her arms, so be it. There was too much human heat here for anything but love-making now. The sky itself, the dreamy stars, the high white clouds, these things as well, decreed it. Chapter 21. She pulled weakly at the buttons of her blouse.
"Undress me, please. Help me," she said.
I quickly removed all her clothes as she wished. She guided me and assisted me. She sank deep in the pillows, pale, but with a body as firm to touch as a young woman's body. I kissed the calves of her legs, her thighs. The garden rustled and sighed behind me. For the first time I heard a waterfall, its gentle trickle, and then I listened to the sound of water touching leaves. But my body was an engine of desire, and what drove me was her naked breasts, rather small, with the pink nipples of a girl, and the smell of death, rising sweet like a crushing lily. It was not that the death attracted me. It was that it made her all the more precious, something to be lost in a moment. She lay back, heaving a deep sigh. The angles of her face were tight and delicate and precise in the dimness.
"Let me see you without your clothes," she said.
She reached for buttons, but I gestured there was no need. I stood up and back from her. Not an electric light burned in the place. It was the dreamiest darkness. I stretched out my arms and looked up at the sky. Though suddenly aware of a fatigue from all the night's tricks, I nevertheless told my clothes to assemble themselves nearby and await my command. I would be naked. It worked even more swiftly and completely than last time. I looked down for the first time on my own chest, pubic hair, erect organ. I was too happy for humility, and to feel the sinews in my arms tighten was to be among living things, and surely some of those things must be good things. She sat up on the bed, her breasts amazingly firm, and the pink nipples turned up. Her silver and black hair made a rumpled mass down her back, and displayed a long neck.
"Splendid," she whispered.
A rain of doubts descended on me. But I had to do it. What was the point of warning her that I might dissolve in the process? I was going to do it. I sat down beside her, embracing her. I felt the moist, thin silkiness of her skin, not healthy in a woman too thin, yet delicious. Even the bones of her wrists were beautiful. She tugged at my hair and kissed me with her eyes closed, all over my face,
and quite suddenly I realized with a shock that my beard and mustache were on my face. She drew back, staring at it. I told this hair to go away.
"No," she said, "bring it back. It makes your mouth sweeter and damper."
I felt the hair return as if it wanted to. I couldn't quite figure this out, why the hair had come of its own, but that was the whole story so far. My body came on its own, and in its own form. One lapse in my will, one drifting into pride in my physical self, and the hair had come. Well, she loved it. I took a long breath, feeling the toll of all this changing and magic, but I was as hard as a statue for her. I wanted to pounce on her. Instead, I let her bury her face in the hair of my chest and kiss my nipples, and the pleasure went right to my loins. I took her breasts in my hands, enchanted by their smallness, their delicacy. So pink, girlish pink. "It's all drugs, my love," she said, as though feeling my wonder. She kissed my beard, kissing it along the bone of my jaw. "It's hormones and modern science. I have a woman's chemicals inside me, that's all. They can make me look young, but they can't save my life." I kissed her and held her, my hands free and rough over her thighs, and stealing into the secret crevice, to feel there the firmness of a young woman's secret body. Chemicals, was it? Modern science? "Those things preserve," I said, "but you make the beauty." "Sweet God," she whispered, kissing me all over my face. I had my hands beneath her small backside and cuddled it. "Yes," I said. "God, capricious as he is, he lavished his blessings on you and on your daughter Esther." "And you were the last thing," she breathed into my ear, her hands clawing gently at my back. "You were the last thing she saw. How good that was for her." A savage strength rose in me, the realization that I had her completely at my mercy, this precious creature, and that no words from anyone could command me away from her. Only her words would hold sway with me now, and only because I would defer to her. It was like fruit between her legs, like peaches or plums. It was just wet enough. I brought my fingers to my nostrils. "I can't hold back, my love," I said. She parted her legs and lifted her hips, and this was paradise suddenly, to be inside her, inside this hot, throbbing fruit, and to have her mouth at the same time, to have both her mouths, to cover her with hair and strength. I began the manly rhythm. Alive, alive, alive. I was blinded. Pleasure drenched all my senses.
"Yes, now. Yes, do it," she said.
She lifted her hips against me. I rose up on my elbows so as not to hurt her with my weight, and looking down at her, I felt the seed explode inside her. My jerking motion surely hurt her. But then I saw the blush I wanted in her face. I felt the throbbing in her throat, and knew she was as happy as I was. The tight little core of fruit squeezed the last drop out of me, and I fell over on my back, whole and alive, staring at the ceiling of this room, or staring into airy dark. Whatever had been my life, spirit or man, I could not recall a pleasure as delicious as this one, as totally humiliating in the way it took over, in the way that it made me feel the slave and the master simultaneously. I didn't ask myself what men felt. Her head turned from side to side. She was blood-red.
"Come to me again, please, now," she said.
Overjoyed, I rolled back on top of her and entered her. I didn't need a rest. The fruity secret part was more luscious, tighter than before, throbbing more fully. Again I came, and her face flooded with blood, and then finally she scratched my back hard with both her hands. She beat on me with fists, and when I lifted up to thrust, she came with me just far enough, and then lay back to make it ecstasy.
"Harder," she said. "Harder. Make this a battlefield. Make me a boy you've found, a girl, I don't care."
It was too inviting. I slammed against her, harshly, over and over, feeling the seed spill again, the sight of her red face filling me with an all-too-human sense of power. Yes, to have her, to make her come, yes, again and again. I filled her up. I was so tight inside her I dragged her hips up off the bed with me. And then, in her wetness, she let me slide back and forth. And, like a brute soldier, I came down, driving her into the silken pillows. And I saw through my half-closed eyes that she smiled.
"Surrender, that's what I want," I said through my teeth.
She could not stop the pleasure coming in her. It came and came as if her heart would break. She was red and tossing, and I wouldn't let her go, slamming again and again against her sweet fruit-like lips, and then she lifted both her arms to cover her face, as if she would hide from me. This sublime gesture, this maidenly gesture, this sweet gesture stripped me of the very last control I ever possessed in this or any other body, and I shot forth my seed for the third time, groaning aloud. Now I was spent. I was tired. And she grew pale in the light of the moon and the white billowing clouds, and we lay there together. My cock was dripping. She turned over, and in the tenderest way, like a little girl almost, she kissed my shoulder. She ran her fingers through the hair on my chest. "My darling," I said. I spoke to her in old languages natural to me, Chaldean, Aramaic. I spoke words of love and testaments of fidelity and devotion, and cooed against her ear, and she rippled with delight against me and tore at my hair again. Pillows had tumbled to the side. The air swirled around her, full of the scents of the garden. It stirred beneath the low white ceiling. And suddenly, as if the wind had changed its direction, there came the song of the sea, the full great sea, relentless, the deceptive song of water, water gurgling in the waterfall that seems to be talking to you when it is saying nothing, has no syllables, and water pounding the beach as if to say, "I am coming, I am coming." But there was no I.
"If I could die now, I would do it," she said. "But there are things you have to know."
I drifted. I dreamed. I felt my fatigue. I shook myself awake. Did I have my body still? I feared sleep. Yet I felt the need of it. The assembled body needed it, as it needed water. I sat up. "Don't talk of dying," I said. "It's going to happen soon enough." I turned and looked down at her. She looked composed, intelligent, all mind with angular collected limbs, quite incapable of the passion we'd just shared. I blurted out, "I have no power to cure, not a disease this far advanced."
"Have I asked you?"
"You must want to know, you must wonder."
"I'll tell you why I didn't ask," she said, reaching up and playfully tugging at the hair on my chest. "I knew if you had the power, you would have helped me the moment you had the chance."
"You're right. You're absolutely right." She closed her eyes and tightened her lids. It was pain. "What can I do?" I said.
"Nothing. I want these drugs to wear off. I want to die on my own."
"I'm ready to bring you anything I can," I said. I was shaken to the bone by the sight of her suffering, but it seemed to melt, and her face was waxen again and perfect.
"You talked about Esther. You said that you wanted to know. Yes, why do you think your husband killed her?"
"I don't know."
"That's just it. They quarreled, but I don't know. I can't believe it was on account of the family. Esther and Gregory fought all the time. It was normal. I don't know.
Tell me everything you remember about Esther and Gregory and this diamond necklace. You said she discovered his brother Nathan when she bought the necklace.
She met Nathan in the diamond district. She could see his resemblance to Gregory, and when she mentioned it, he confessed he was Gregory's identical twin.
Ah, identical.
But what could it all mean? He told her he was Gregory's twin. He told her to give Gregory his love. She was amazed. She liked him. She met the other Hasidim who work in the store with him. She liked Nathan very much. She said it was like looking at the man Gregory could have been, all filled up with gentleness and kindness. The day she died, I'm sure she took the necklace back to Nathan. I think I remember her saying that she had to drop it off, because some small thing was wrong and Nathan would fix it. And she said, "Don't tell the Messiah that I'm going to visit his brother." And she laughed. I think she dropped it off before those killers got her. Gregory knew she was shopping that day at Henri Bendel. He knew that. But I don't think he knew about the necklace. It wasn't till yesterday that the whole issue of the necklace came up. I didn't even know the necklace was gone. Nobody did. Then Gregory brought it up, that the terrorists had seized her necklace and killed her. Sure enough, the necklace was gone, but I couldn't reach Nathan to find out if he had it. Besides, he would have called. I know Nathan only by voice, but I know him now, through one phone call.
Go back now to the earlier part. Esther quarreled with Gregory about his brother, and the brother was an identical twin.
She had wanted him to meet with his brother. He had been frantic that she tell no one about the Hasidim, no one. He told her it was a matter of life or death. He tried to frighten her. I know Gregory. I know him when he's weak and not thinking too clearly, when he's caught off guard and is furious and desperate.
I've seen this too, I said, a glimpse of it.
Well, that's how he was with her. No, 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 you didn't meet any brother. I have no brother. Then he came storming into me and desperately appealed to me in Yiddish to explain to her how the Hasidim would not want to be connected with him. But he was furious about the whole affair. She didn't speak Yiddish, Esther. She came into the room, and I remember he turned and he said, "You ever tell anyone about Nathan, and I'll never forgive you." She was so confused. I drew her aside, tried to explain how the observant Jews would not like Jews like us, who didn't pray each day, or observe the laws of the Talmud. She listened, but I could see she didn't grasp this. She said, "But Nathan said he loved Gregory. He said he would love to see his brother. He said that from time to time he tries to call Gregory, but he can't get through." I thought Gregory would go out of his mind. "I don't want to hear any more of this," he said. "If you gave him my private number, tell me now. These people hurt me. I left when I was a boy. They hurt me. I made my own church, my own tribe, my own way. I am my Messiah." I tried to calm him down. I said, "Gregory, please, we're not in a television pulpit. Sit down, rest." Then Esther demanded to know why Gregory had been so kind to Nathan in taking him to the hospital. She said Nathan had told her all about that, this time in the hospital, how Gregory had checked Nathan into the hospital under his own name and had paid all his expenses and kept Nathan in a private suite and didn't want to worry the Rebbe or his wife about it, took care of all of it. She said, "Nathan said you were so generous." I swear to you, I thought he would go crazy. I started to see how complex this was. Gregory had something at stake other than mere publicity. In fact, it was perfectly obvious to me that the Hasid connection would be a help to Gregory with his church, a form of occult status. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do exactly. Exotic and pure roots had grown this great leader.
Yes. So I sat up and tried to ask a few questions. Why had Nathan been in the hospital?
And Esther said that Gregory had suggested it. Gregory had told Nathan that they were both at risk for something inherited in their family, and knowing the Rebbe would never agree, he had spirited Nathan away and had all the tests done under Gregory's name. For Nathan it had been a dream. The beautiful hospital suite, kosher food, all the proprieties observed, and the people thinking he was Gregory. He found it amusing. Of course, he didn't have the hereditary disease, whatever that was.
God, what on earth?
Ah, I see, I said.
What does all this amount to?
Keep telling me everything about Nathan and Esther, I said. What else do you know?
Oh, that first night, we fought for hours about it. Finally she agreed she wouldn't tell anyone, or try to bring the families together, but she would see Nathan from time to time and give him Gregory's good wishes. Gregory began to cry with relief. Gregory can cry on cue and on camera. He went into how his people had cast him out. The temple was everything to him, his meaning, his life. Whenever he went into that speech, Esther and I would just roll our eyes. We knew that he had compiled the teachings of the Temple of the Mind with a computer program. He had programmed in all the information he could about other cults, and which commandments had given the members the most comfort, and then he had chosen a list of the most acceptable and likable commandments. Other aspects of the temple were created the same way, through secret surveys and computer compilation of the most appealing aspects of other religions. It was a joke to Esther and me. But that night he wept and wept. It was his whole life. God had guided him and his computer. I went to sleep. 2 days Esther and Gregory didn't speak to each other. But that was nothing unusual. They could have fought over some little political question and scream. It was the way they acted together.
What else?
2 nights later, Gregory woke me at 4 o'clock. He was in one of his rages. He said, "Take the phone, talk to him, listen to him yourself." I didn't know what the hell he meant. The voice coming through the phone sounded exactly like Gregory. I mean, exactly. I could scarcely believe it was another person, but it was. And he introduced himself as Nathan, Gregory's brother. He asked me kindly to explain to Esther that the families couldn't get together. "This breaks my heart, that I must say this to my brother's wife," he said. "But our grandfather doesn't have long to live, and the court depends on him. He is the Rebbe. Tell Esther that it can't be, and give her my love, and in time I will see her when she comes to visit me." I told him I understood perfectly. "You have my love too, brother-in-law. I too lost my parents in the camps. I wish you only well." Then, in Yiddish, he said we were in his prayers and in his thoughts, and if we ever needed him, if Gregory was ever ill or afraid, we must call him. I told him how good it was to hear a Yiddish voice and to talk with him. He laughed and said something like, "Gregory thinks he has everything, and thank God he has a good wife, but you never know when a brother will need a brother. Gregory has never been sick a day in his life, never been inside a hospital, except to visit me, of course, and take care of me. But I will come if he ever calls." I remember thinking about this hospital stay, these tests. Had Gregory himself had such tests? What was this hereditary disease? I knew it was true that Gregory had never been in a hospital. Gregory had a private doctor, hardly what I would call a licensed practitioner of medicine, but he had never, to my knowledge, been in a hospital. I said to Nathan how kind he was, and I asked how I might reach him, and then Gregory grabbed the phone back. He carried it out of the room with him, but I could hear him talking Yiddish in a simple, natural way, and intimately, in a way Gregory never spoke to anyone. I was really for the first time hearing him speak to a brother. I had never heard that. I had always been told that all Gregory's people were dead, all of them.
"How long ago was all this?" I asked.
"About a month ago. but I didn't even think of it before now, all this. I mean, I knew in my heart that he had been responsible for Esther's death. I knew when I heard him make his speech about terrorism and enemies that he'd been lying. He was too prepared for Esther's death. But honestly, frankly, do you think he would kill his own daughter because of all this?
Yes, I do. But I see a large design here, I said. And the Rebbe, you never met or spoke to the Rebbe?
No, she said.
I wouldn't go over there to be rejected. I have great reverence for those people. My parents were Hasidim from Poland. But no, I know that kind of old man.
Well, let me tell you this.
That old man also accused Gregory of killing Esther. And he wanted to know the same thing you wanted to know. Why?
Do you realize what this means? She said.
If he would kill Esther to protect the family secret, then he might kill Nathan.
Has there been no call from Nathan concerning this necklace? I asked.
I know how the Hasidim live, but this is news. Diamonds, you know. Talk of valuable diamonds snatched by terrorists.
No, no call that I know of. But you see, I'm cut off. I was surrounded by the Minders. And Gregory himself didn't even come up with the necklace part till the day after the murder. In his first speech, all he did was talk about enemies. Then the next day he...
My God, maybe that's when Nathan called him. But then he wouldn't have told such a lie, or...
Why in the hell did he bring up the necklace?
I was quietly absorbing all these words. I think I can figure it out, I said. One thing is true, I foiled his plan. His plan is big. His design is big. I foiled it by killing those tramps that murdered her. So that blurred his attempt at calling it all terrorism. Those men cannot be traced to terrorists, can they?
No, not at all. Half the world is crying with him, and others are laughing at him. The men were bums out of some town in South Texas. Bums! Now Gregory claims his enemies will use any means to hurt him, and these bums were part of it, and the theft was to give them badly needed wealth to fight his church.
Let's leave the necklace for a moment. He still played up the terrorist part, and for some strange reason included the necklace. Now listen, I have to ask you. Why are there laboratories in the Temple of the Mind? Why?
Laboratories? She asked. I have no idea. I didn't even know there were. Of course there's Gregory's own doctor, who pumps him up with human growth hormone and special protein drinks and anything else he can to keep his youth and strength. And they do have some kind of hospital room so that if Gregory runs a temperature 1 degree above normal, his doctor can examine him in it. But there are no laboratories as such, not as far as I know.
No, no, I mean big laboratories where people are working with chemicals and computers. Huge laboratories with sterile storage and people even dressed in funny clothes to protect themselves. I saw this tonight. I saw this in the Temple of the Mind. I saw some people wearing orange clothes that covered their whole bodies. I didn't think of it at the time. I was just looking for Gregory.
Orange suits? You're talking about suits that protect people from viruses. Good Lord, is there disease at the heart of this? Gregory has some disease? What the hell did he do to Nathan in the hospital?
I think I know. He didn't hurt his brother. And there is no disease in Gregory, I can tell you that for sure, or in the Rebbe. I would have known the moment I saw them. I sense these things. She winced, the mere thought of her own sickness suddenly confusing her and muddling her mind. What does the temple do that would require a team of doctors?